Station number 7257.
Mr. Lane, tape 5. Did you ever come up against Padres in the at the front?
Well, I only saw two Padres actually in the front line during my whole service. One was at Givenchy. He seemed very, very, very despondent about the whole affair, which he well might be. The other one was on the first day of the Battle of what is called Passchendaele. We were advancing and we stopped at the River Steenbeck, Stenebeke. We were all lying down and I suddenly felt an object fall at my side. I looked around and it was a tin of woodvines. I looked around again, there was a padre. I'd never seen anybody, any padre, taking part in an attack. And I don't know who he was, I don't know what religion he was, but whoever he was worthy of the highest praise because he was in a very dangerous position. And that's all I've got to say about padres in the First World War. I don't remember having a church parade. Remember, we might have had one. You've got to remember that all this is all spoken from memory, you know, and it can't be absolutely certified accurate, but it's accurate in its generality, but it might be wrong in detail. But that parson I do remember quite well.
I haven't actually asked you what rank you were.
Well, I was only a It's a funny thing, I often wonder about that, but it was, well, I haven't wondered, I know what the position was, but I was one of the first to be promoted out there to Lance Corporal, and then an incident happened, I can't quite remember when it was, but we were in the line one night, and I was standing outside the company sergeant major's dugout. And the enemy opened a box barrage. Well, that was a barrage all round a position. You see, it was at the time when they used to raid trenches, you know. Everybody was terrified of it, really. We used to do it too. And they just put a box barrage around so you couldn't get up the communication trench, you couldn't reinforce. They'd come in, chuck a few bombs down and take a prisoner and be off. Anyway, this box barrage opened. I was standing just outside, in the support line, outside the Sergeant Major's dugout. After about 10 minutes or so, we were expecting a raid. After about 10 minutes or so, a man ran out from the front, front line, into the Sergeant Major's dugout, and I went in with him. The sergeant major was shaking like an aspen leaf, and this man who ran out of the line said that they were being attacked, they were being raided. Now, the sergeant major said to me, "Corporal, take up another man and take up some Mills bombs to the front line." Well, of course, that was going up a communication trench too. That job was nothing unusual. I mean, I knew that it was dangerous, of course, going up a communication trench, but we went up there, we took a couple of boxes of Mills and bombs. Well, there had been no attack on the front line, we found, although they were expecting one. We came back to the dugout, to the Sergeant Major's dugout, I should have said. And the man that had come out of the front line was still there. The sergeant major never left his dugout. The shelling stopped soon after, and that was the end of that. But I could not refrain from telling this story about what had happened to one or two other friends of mine, and it got round to the Sergeant Major that I had done so. Now, the strange thing is that the man who had run out of the front line was awarded the military medal. And the Sergeant Major, I imagine, was so scared of this man that that was the only thing he could do to sort of buy him off. Although the man himself, in fact, should have been court-martialed for running out of the front line, because nobody had sent him out of the front line. It was quite clear he came down to the Sergeant Major's dugout to get out of the danger. You see, that was why it was. Anyway, that was that. I could tell you another...
But were you promoted after this?
No, of course not. No. The Sergeant Major got to know that I'd...
Oh, yeah. That I'd spent... Otherwise, yes, I see.
Yes, of course. And there was, no doubt, there was considerable enmity between me and the company Sergeant Major. Anyway, it didn't matter. I mean, I was never bothered about promotion at all. When we left England and went to France, I had two very special friends, or one in particular. And our sole aim was to keep together, you see.
What was his name?
Comradeship. The one, Joe Langley. He comes from Waltham Cross. He's dead now, poor Joe. And I kept this friendship up long after. In fact, I went to his funeral. I used to see him regularly, two or three or four times a year. Now, he wasn't educated, well, neither was I come to that, but he only had an elementary education, but he was very intelligent, you see. And he was really a great friend of mine. And he had a very sort of adventurous life after that, but that's nothing to do with this story, of course. Anyway, our idea was to keep together. Neither of us had any ambitions, so that promotion was not regarded as anything that we craved for at all.
How important was it to have a good friend?
Well, that's another thing. Comradeship was one of the best features of the 19... Comradeship in the trenches, one of the best features of the 1914 war. There is nothing... In civilian life, call it friendship, call it what you will, to equal the sense of comradeship in the trenches in the 1914 war. I can remember that one of my comrades got wounded in 1915, and this induced in me a sense of desolation, which normally would only come if you'd lost a very close family, a member of your family, really. It's that sort of feeling. For quite a time, you felt absolutely, you know, completely desolate. I remember a Joe getting wounded in 1915. Got shot through the arm. Of course, I aimed him, mind you, in a way, because it was a lovely wound right through the muscle there. Got him back to England. But there is that feeling of comradeship, which can't be understood by anybody unless they've actually been, were actually in the front line in the 1914 war. It was a sort of trust between men that rarely occurs. There was no reason for any hatred or rancor of any kind. Everyone was out to help each other. And that's the one good feature of the 1914 war that you'll never get in civilian life. It can only occur in situations of great stress, of rigorous conditions, and can only be... How would I want to say? and can only be acquired in wartime.
Could I ask you a little more about the conditions?
Well,
did you ever... You've mentioned when you went back for rest periods, you said once there were no rats. That rather implied you were familiar
rats,
with them.
Well, now, then, rats were... Whenever the 1914 war is mentioned, the rats are always mentioned with it. Well, the fact is, so far as I was concerned, the rats in the trenches rarely occurred, or anyway the worst experience of rats that I incurred was in barns. I remember one place particular. We went into a barn. It had straw on the floor, and there were rafters going across sort of two or three beams. Well, the first night there was a nightmare. Rats were crossing these beams, dropping off onto us the whole night long. And it was there that I first acquired the habit, which was a habit among troops, of always going to sleep with a blanket right over your head. You never left your face bare, you always had a blanket right over your head. And I carried on that at home when I got home too, for a time. Anyway, that was that.
Did you ever have fleas, you realise?
Oh, yes, fleas. Every man in the front line was in a state of, what do they call it? Every man in the front line had fleas after about two or three weeks. These used to get into the seams of your underclothes, and the only way to get rid of them was to get a candle and go along the seams with a candle, and you could hear the eggs crackling. And the extraordinary thing is that these lice were so bad in places. I've seen men taking their shirts off with the skin of their back absolutely raw, where they've been scratching, you know, like that sort of thing. Yeah. And there was no way of getting rid of them at all. We used to have sent out a chemical called Harrison's Pomade. And we used to use that, but it wasn't very effective. No, lice were a curse. They were a real menace to us. Because, for one thing, you had very few chances of getting a good sleep anyway. And when you had, the lice would be there to irritate you, drive you sort of into a frenzy almost. But the whole thing was that the lice were in the dugouts. Apparently the whole trench system was full of lice. But we used to get a bath later on in the war, and we used to march to a nearby town or village where huge vats would be set up, and we would get into these, and our underclothes would be taken, and we would be issued with new underclothes, so that for a time we would be free from lice. But this happened very rarely. I mean, it go months without having a bath, of course. And then there was a case of feet, trench feet. The idea was that living in a trench which was waterlogged and never being allowed to take off your boots set up the condition called trench feet. This was, I never had it myself, but this was a very painful affair, apparently. Eventually, they introduced as a preventative an arrangement whereby before going into the trenches, you had to rub into your feet whale oil. This really was effective. And I think once it wasn't brought into use to well into the war in the 1916, I suppose. And I believe it had the effect of preventing trench feet to quite a large extent.
Could you ever get a wash?
No, not that. Well, not, you can never get a bath. I mean, no. You had to go to a bath. You get a wash in the summertime, if you're anywhere near a stream, of course, you go and jump in there, but no, you can never get a wash. You got to shave every day when you were out of the line. You had to shave.
Did you?
Wash. Oh, yes. Now, shaving. In our battalion, we weren't required to shave while in the trenches. This was an excellent arrangement. There was an occasion when, in the Ypres sector, the front line had been taken over by another regiment, and it was in the winter time, and the troops in the front line and the support line occupied a part of a communication trench. It was in the winter, but at this particular morning, on this particular morning, it was quite clear, frosty and brilliant sunshine. Apparently, the colonel of that regiment ordered his men to get shaved. Now, in the Ypres salient, we were under observation all the time. And this particular trench, which was really a communication trench, and therefore the enemy were able to catch it in enfilade, the Germans evidently saw these razors flashing in the sunshine and opened a terrific bombardment and killed and wounded quite a number of men. Now that's the stupidity of the British Army. It was a Cambridge regiment really, but I suppose that's gone in there now. But that's Colonel Orton, well, I don't know. That's what happened. But a lot of silly things like that happened, you know. The whole thing was madness, really.
How about toilets? How did you cope in that respect? It must have been very difficult.
Latrine, you see, every trench had a latrine. Now, that was another thing that could cause. It was sited at the back of the trench. That isn't a parallel. And the fact that people were trooping up and down there would come under the notice of the Germans, and very often they would start shelling around that area. You know, yeah, it was a dangerous position, really, dangerous practice. So most people left it till dark before getting there if they could possibly help it. Yeah.
How about language? Did you find, you know, people let off steam and swore quite a lot?
We were swearing all the time. I mean, the word bloody was part of the common day language. Oh, yes. And much worse words than that, of course. Oh, it was, the language was, well, it always had been in the army, I believe. But certainly it was during the Great War, the 1914 War. People were swearing all the time. I mean, you didn't take any notice of it. It was just, the word bastard was used quite a lot too. Especially in the regular army. That's the strange thing about that, because I remember being told on joining a regular regiment by one of the men, he said, never call anybody a bastard, you see. And I realised later on that went back traditionally, and the reason why nobody was called a bastard was the fact that most of them were bastards. You can see that this chap was actually a bastard himself. And in the old days, you know, even the poorest people, a bastard was one of the worst things you could call anybody, you know. Even though they were bastards. I mean, one of those things, it's almost blasphemy to call anybody a bastard in those days. And of course, the old regular army was regarded as a scum of the earth. I don't know if you've read that at all. And it was, in fact, it was really, it did contain a lot of the dropouts and people who joined the army needed to get some food. That's why a lot of them joined, you see. And I'm not blaming them for being dropouts because they were brought up in homes that could only produce dropouts, you see. But they were very good. A lot of them were very good. A lot of these old regular soldiers were quite good comrades, really. But now in the Royal Artillery, I've heard it said that the word bastards was used as a term of endearment. So that's a different aspect of it, you see. But I know that that in the pre-1914 days, it was regarded as almost blasphemous to use the word bastard against any particular person. You could call the colonel a bastard or the general, but you mustn't say, "Old so-and-so, he's a bastard," you know. You mustn't say that.
You mentioned earlier on gambling. Did this go on quite a lot?
Yes, in a very mild way. It would be very difficult to be extravagant in gambling on a shilling a day.
That was your pay, was it?
Well, you get a bit more for proficiency pay, but 1 or 6 a day is most you did get as a private anyway, you see. The thing was, of course, that you couldn't spend anything while you were in the trenches, obviously. So that when you went back for a rest, you usually had about 5 or 10 francs to spend, you see. And of course, the cost of living was very low in those days, and you could get in Basque, and you could get beer, Basque beer, at quite a reasonable price. I'm not sure what it was. So you get mildly tiddly for a few bob, you see, or a few francs. And a lot of them used to drink this Vin Blanc and this white wine. Well, that was just a horrible stuff, really. You could buy a whole Dixie for, that's a quart almost, for about for a franc anyway. So there was a certain amount of drinking, but not so much as it in England today, nothing like there is in England today. I mean, in England, England's going alcoholic, isn't it, today?
What games did you play for gambling? Can you remember any?
Brag, pontoon, and kittynap.
What was that?
Well, I've often tried to think of it, but we used to enjoy that quite a bit. It was very much there used to be five cards to kittynap, they called. There used to be 5 cards dealt out, and the rest were the pack was put away, and I don't know, you didn't use all cards. I can't remember exactly how it was played, but it was quite a simple game, you know, kittynap, brag, pontoon. That's about all. Nothing like bridge, nothing intellectual at all, nothing like bridge, and we used to do quite a lot of that. Well, that's all you could do, really. Nothing else. So no, absolutely no. It must have been, I often wonder how we got over the boredom of it all. You just imagine, nobody can imagine being stuck in a trench 6 feet high in the middle of winter, day after day, and nothing to do at all, really. There's nothing you could do. I'm talking about a quiet period, when there was nothing much doing, because there were periods when, perhaps for days on end, apart from sniping, you'd always got to be careful about that, there'd be no shell fire at all, you know. And, you know, you just didn't know what to do, so you gambled.
Did you get letters from home?
Oh, yes, regularly. Yeah.
And you wrote back, did you?
Yeah.
Was that very important, to get mail?
Well, in a way, I suppose, yes.
Did you have a girlfriend?
Pardon?
Did you have a girlfriend?
Oh, yes, that was my girlfriend. She was my girlfriend. But not really. I mean, we weren't, there was nothing, nothing subtle about it. No engagement or anything. Oh, yes, I used to have one or two go like that. Yeah, you like to get a letter, of course. But the people at home got no idea what was going on, and they never will have. There's no good telling them. You couldn't possibly do it. Anyway, human nature won't stand that sort of thing. I mean, just because somebody else is suffering, that doesn't mean to say that they're not going. I mean, you get it now, you get it everywhere, don't you? I mean, it doesn't matter where a war is, the women or the people are concerned. Are not going to lead quiet and righteous lives just because somebody else. It's not in human nature, really.
How about parcels? Were these important?
Yes, we got parcels. Yes, we got parcels. We got parcels from home, and we got parcels from the local. That's what they used to do at home. They used to give us parcels of chocolate and that sort of thing. I thought that was, they were doing their bit then, you see.
You were saying in the beginning how cold you were in the first winter of the war.
Well, no, not that. Yes, no, we're wet.
Yeah. Were you given better equipment as the war went on?
No, not really. No, the coldest winter was the winter of 1916-17. Now, during that winter, I think it was one of the coldest winters for a good many years. We were in the Ypres salient, and in the front line, I can remember, we weren't allowed to have a brazier because it weren't far away from the enemy, and we couldn't brew up tea, but we used to have tea sent up to us at the communication trench. Well, a communication trench can be as much as 3/4 of a mile long, because it goes like that, you see, all around. I mean, obviously, that's to prevent the effects of the shells, you see. And it used to start off in a huge Dixie. Two men would carry it, sort of with a, like a stretcher. It would start off boiling hot. By the time it got to us in the front line, there was ice on the top. It was so cold.